On this episode of Aviator Cast, the Kobe Bryant crash from a flight instructor's perspective.
Welcome, aviators, to another episode of Aviator Cast. Load up your flight bag with useful flight training topics, interviews, and aviation passion. Let's kick the tires and light the fires. Coming to you from Angle of Attack Headquarters in Homer, Alaska, here's your host and flight instructor, Chris Palmer.
All right, everyone, welcome to Aviator Cast. It's great to have you here today. Today we have a little bit more of a sobering subject, so I don't want to act happy or anything like that. I guess I just want to be respectful to this particular subject because it is something that's been on almost everyone's mind, at least a little bit, the last several weeks. Seems to have even stuck through the regular crazy news cycle and has gotten a lot of attention, and that is the Kobe Bryant accident that happened on January 26th. And in recording this podcast right now, it is February 14th. It's actually Valentine's Day. So it hasn't been long, but there are a number of details that we know already. So in this podcast, we are going to talk about that crash. We're going to talk about my initial reactions to it, just kind of personally, and my thoughts on it. And a little bit on how I treat accidents in general, the details we received after several days, the new details from the NTSB on the accident itself, so some sobering information there, and what we know about the pilot, the helicopter, and the operator, which is enlightening too, and then my perspective, this is my opinion and everything, on what we can learn and what we can do to learn from this and make it a positive for the future of aviation. So that's what we're going to get into now. And I hope that you guys find this useful. I want to be really respectful through this process. You know, I've avoided having the knee-jerk reaction to come right out and talk about this. Generally, I hold back on accidents as a whole. I would say always. You probably have never seen me do any accident reporting or investigations or anything like that on my channel because I don't want it to seem like I am exploiting these situations at all. And so even though there was a whole lot of media coverage on the Kobe Bryant accident, I don't want to be anywhere near that and make it seem like I'm exploiting that for views or anything. But as I talked to some other people that are followers, they said that they would really value my perspective on this. And we did cover this a little bit in the flight instructor refresher course this last weekend. So I feel like it is a little bit of my duty as a professional instructor, as an aviation educator, to share my thoughts on this. I'm not sure if there will be people that are non-aviation people that watch this, podcast or this video, but I hope that if there are, that you can glean some more information from the professional side of aviation that that we think about when we think about accidents like this. And you know, we take this very seriously, and of course, as even a pilot community, we're all disheartened by a lot of what we've seen from this, but we learn and we move forward and we do what we can to prevent something like this from happening again. So my initial reaction was one where I wasn't really impacted too much because I don't have a personal connection to Kobe Bryant. I am not a Lakers fan. I'm not really even a basketball fan. I was back in the day when the Utah Jazz did really well with Stockton and Malone. I grew up in Utah. And he kind of came into the picture at the tail end of that journey. So I knew who he was. I knew that he was one of the greats, right? And of course, the name right away popped out. I know who he is. And when I heard that this whole thing happened, I didn't necessarily like have a personal emotional reaction to the fact that it was Kobe Bryant. I did have more of an emotional reaction to wanting to know who else was on board because I knew that obviously someone was flying him and there had to be other people on board. Initially, they were even saying only 5 people were on board. Turns out that there ended up being 9 people on board. But I just wanted to know who else was on board because there was loss of life even beyond the celebrity of Kobe Bryant and his daughter Gianna. There were other people involved that meant a lot to people as well. So that's one thing that kind of impacted me initially, that the loss of life, no matter what it was very important and critical and sad, and I wanted to know more about that rather than it just being about Kobe Bryant, but also being about the others. I am not a Monday morning quarterback. I can say that with confidence. And what that means is that the morning after an accident like this, I don't sit there and act like I know everything and that I could give advice or give facts about the situation. So, you know, football is on Sunday and the game's over, right? Everything's been done. Everything's been played. And on Monday, the quarterback comes in, keyboard warrior, whatever it is, and tries to add their advice. And so that's why I've held off on this topic quite a bit because there is a lot of information that comes out fairly quickly, especially high profile events like this. But it does take several days for the facts to start to come together to realize what exactly happened. So I always wait for info, and no matter what it is, and I would ask you to do the same too. If you don't do that, then what ends up happening is you draw conclusions to what it was and what happened, and a lot of the times we missed a lesson in that because we thought it was something that it wasn't, and move on to other news or whatever it is. But there's a lot to learn in the details on these aviation accidents, which makes it very important. So I wanted to name the people that were on board and share a little bit more of my emotional reaction after a few days, because obviously there was a lot of media coverage on this, and I even have some videos to share with you too. So the people that were on board were Kobe Bryant, who he was young, he was 41 years old, his daughter Gianna, John Altobelli, his wife Carrie, and his daughter Alyssa. His daughter Alyssa played with this basketball camp, as I understand it, that Kobe Bryant does, which is called the Mamba basketball camp or something like that. And so John was like a local kind of baseball guy and taught baseball at a college here, coached baseball. So he, his wife, and his daughter Alyssa were on board. Christina Mauser was an elementary basketball coach, and she was also an assistant coach at the Mamba Academy. And Sarah Chester, who brought her daughter Peyton along. Peyton was a player at the Mamba Academy, so her mother and the daughter Peyton were both on board, Sarah Chester and Peyton Chester. And then Ara Zaboyan, who was the pilot. So those are the 9 people on board that passed away. And I just thought I'd honor their names by mentioning them name by name, and that they, you know, I read some stories about each one of them. Each one of them had such an impact on people. And Christina Mauser, for example, it hits a little bit more close home to me because she is a mother of three kids. And now the dad said that he's kind of in crisis because now he has three kids to take care of and he doesn't know what he's going to do. And, you know, I'm a father of two young boys, so I think about that a lot. But a beautiful group here, people that were working toward great goals. Apparently the Mamba Basketball Academy was just like really, really cool and good. And I caught a glimpse of that from some of the videos that I started to watch about Kobe Bryant. And so I'm going to play a couple of those now and just kind of give you the impact that they had on me. And I think that you will glean something from them as well. So let me pull those up now. So this one is Kobe Bryant just talking, I guess, inspirationally. And he's not even talking about baseball. He's just talking about things in general. And I feel like the words that he was echoing are often the words that I echo on this podcast about aviation, about chasing your dreams and putting in the hard work. So let's listen to this from Kobe Bryant. Again, these videos are what gave me a little bit more emotional connection to who he is and why it was such a loss for, I guess you could say, humanity.
Hello, everyone. I'm so sorry I can't be with you tonight. However, I couldn't completely miss the chance to take a moment to share some thoughts with all of you. The lesson I cherish the most is how important it is to love what you do. If you love what you do and it's making you happy, all the hard work and perseverance will pay off. I once had a guidance counselor tell me that I shouldn't play basketball, that it would never amount to anything for me. His negativity towards me made me stronger. You can't stop people from trying to limit your dreams, but you can stop it from becoming a reality. Your dreams are up to you. I encourage you to always be curious, always seek out things you love, and always work hard once you find it. So with that, I'll let you carry on with your evening. Please know I'm thinking of you, supporting you, and encouraging you always. Peace.
I feel like that particular video echoes a lot of my feelings about aviation. You know, it's a passion. It does take hard work. I was told pretty early on that I couldn't do it, and I didn't take no for an answer. And just like the encouraging nature of Kobe Bryant, I saw a lot of myself in him, in what I do, and encouraging others. And that just it really impacted me and showed me that, gosh, this guy was... he was doing really good things with his celebrity. I wasn't privy to that while he was alive, but he was out there encouraging people and helping them achieve their dreams and being a positive force, which I just think is so important in today's day and age. There are people out there that are still doing that. Follow that up with another video that he did here, where he's discussing why he decided to start traveling by helicopter. So this is a very, very interesting look into why he was jumping around via helicopter. Let's listen to this.
Even on weekends.
You know, after school activities, all that fun stuff, even on weekends. But then traffic started getting really, really bad. Right. And I was sitting in traffic and I wound up missing like a school play because mm-hmm. I was sitting in traffic and this thing just kept mounting. I had to figure out a way where I could still train and focus on the craft, but still not compromise family time. Mm-hmm. And so that's when I looked into helicopters and be able to get down and back in 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. And that's when it started. And so my routine was always the same. Weights early in the morning, kids to school, fly down, practice like crazy, do my extra work, media, everything I needed to do. Fly back, get back in carpool line, pick the kids up. And my wife was like, listen, I can pick them up. I'm like, no. I want to do that because, mm-hmm. like, you know, you have road trips and times where you don't see your right. kids, man. Right. You know, so, like, every chance I get to see them and spend time with them, even if it's 20 minutes in the car, like, I want that.
So, literally, the reason why Kobe Bryant decided to use helicopters to get around wasn't to fit more, you know, fancy dinners in or whatever. It was to have more family time, to have more time for his family to do the small things that matter so much. And that really impacted me as well. So, you know, I say whatever you want about Kobe Bryant. I know that there's a history there as well with the law, apparently, with a case. Anyway, leave that all behind. Like, humans are humans. We're here now. We have someone that is encouraging the community. He's a family guy and a great example to others. And I just think that that was also really impactful for me. Now, those are both, obviously, one was like broadcasted maybe at a basketball game. The other one was on some sort of podcast or video show of some kind. But this one is for an individual. So apparently this guy ran across Kobe and told him that his son had basketball tryouts, and Kobe wanted to record a personal message for just one person. And this is what he said here. Again, relate this to aviation, okay? Because I think that there, even from Kobe, there's so much to learn about aviation.
Andre, what's up? What's going on? It's Kobe. And Pops tells me you got tryouts next week, yeah? You made it through the first leg of tryouts, and now here you are again, right? So the most important thing is go out there and just do your best. Don't worry about the person next to you. Don't worry about the other kids that are playing. Just play your absolute best, right? And play for the love of the game, and everything will work out just fine. And basketball, just like anything else, the more you do it, the better you get. I wish there was a magic wand. Actually, I don't, because then it takes away the fun of the actual hard work. So just work hard and get better. Best of luck to you, my brother. Much love.
And isn't that true, that in aviation, it takes a lot of hard work? And he said, I wish I had a magic wand. And no, actually, I don't, because that's part of the journey. It's so true. Anyway, I just thought I'd share you those actual examples, because I'm sure there are those of you out there that aren't emotionally connected to Kobe Bryant. But through seeing those examples, you can see why this is something that impacted people so much, because this is how he operated. This is what he did after basketball. And I'm sure he was like this during basketball, too. Anyway, we can all gain from excellent people like Kobe Bryant, okay? And it really helps us become more excellent no matter where we're at. And of course, those of you that are here listening to this podcast or watching it on YouTube, you are the type of people that are trying to grow a career in aviation or just become a safe recreational pilot in aviation. And there is something to learn from that, you know? Absolutely. So I just thought I would maybe bring it a little bit closer to home. So you could have maybe a little bit of your own emotion behind this now. All right, so now we're going to get into more of the nitty-gritty details of this accident, what we know, what happened, etc. So here is a synopsis of what happened during the flight, the day that this happened. And, you know, if I miss a thing here and there facts-wise, I'm sorry. I've tried to do my best to research it. There are some pretty good videos on YouTube that show like the exact 3D path of the flight and also the communications, but this is the gist of what happened, okay, without rehashing all of that material. So the helicopter was on a flight from John Wayne to Camarillo, and that's actually where I'm at now. I'm recording this literally 100 yards from the runway. The weather was poor on that day. It was marginal VFR at best, but sometimes it was IFR. The pilot was flying low, following roads, and contending with airspace and terrain along the way. This is pretty common for helicopters to do. They'll follow roads. They have lower weather minimums because they're more maneuverable. So they were doing the typical thing of helicopter traffic and kind of picking their way through the weather. They had to hold outside of Burbank for a little bit, doing some circles because there was some IFR traffic in there. So that gives you an idea for the type of traffic we're talking about, or rather the type of day we're talking about, that people were actually shooting approaches and doing IFR type things. Eventually he was cleared to go through, he meaning the pilot, the pilot was cleared to go through Burbank and Van Nuys airspace and up into the Simi Valley. There's a lot of airspace kind of sandwiched in there. Burbank and Van Nuys are right next to each other, and then there's some mountains and then Camarillo to the west. So they were trying to work their way that direction. There is a way to go through the Simi Valley, but apparently once they got there and looked, the weather wasn't good, and so they decided to go over Highway 101, which would go through the mountains and up over the top. And it does kind of go up over a hump, a ridge, and then back down into the Camarillo or the Ventura Valley, Oxnard area. I don't know if that makes sense to anyone, but goes up the mountains and then comes back down. So during that process, the weather was persistent, like a persistent overcast layer, pretty typical of some of Southern California, California in general, of some of the coastal weather that can happen. And so that's what was happening that day, is some persistent layers. At some point, he requested a special VFR, which would allow him to fly at lower minimums and still stay legal. So a special VFR is something not a lot of people know about. It's technically still VFR, but your minimums come way down. So I know for airplanes, it's one statute mile clear of clouds. That is really low, very, very low. Even three statute miles, 3.152, which is another kind of minimums we use for aviation, is still, when you're in that weather, it's still pretty low. So this was low weather that they were dealing with, and mostly contending with the ceiling, but they were also reporting 2 miles visibility at times. So they were contending with a lot weather-wise. So the weather wasn't good, and they tried another way. They went, again, over Highway 101, and as the terrain was rising, they were following the road and they kept climbing, but the ceilings, as they were getting closer to the coast, or maybe the weather was interacting with the mountains a little bit, the ceiling was coming down a little bit too. So they eventually ran out of space between their altitude and the road and the clouds, and they flew into the clouds. So the pilot executed a climb. He communicated with ATC that they would need advisories. And that is one of the last radio calls that they received from the pilot. The pilot wasn't necessarily on flight following or anything at that point because he was so low over terrain. So they didn't have great radar contact with them and great communication. Now from here, the details are that the helicopter entered a left turning descent at one point, reaching as much as 4,000 feet per minute, negative. So a negative descent of 4,000 feet per minute to the left. And if you look at the radar path, it's just a slow but steep curve right into the mountain. It impacted terrain. This is an important fact that came out from the NTSB. It impacted terrain with the engines running, the blades turning, and the tail rotor turning as well. So that says to us that the aircraft was completely fine. It wasn't some sort of mechanical failure of some kind that caused this. So a little bit more about the pilot. You know, people always ask, is this someone that was really inexperienced? What happened? Why would someone do this? How did this, if the helicopter was operating perfectly fine, how could it have just crashed? And then you start to look to the pilot and try to lay blame on them, which it's almost always the pilot's fault when it comes to an accident. So the pilot had 8,200 hours, nearly 1,300 hours in this type of helicopter, which is no small amount of time. He was also an instructor with an instrument instructor license and had recently gone through recurrent training with his company. He even had training on inadvertent entrance into IMC during that recurrent training, which, if I remember correctly, was done. Well, it was done in 2019. can't remember if it was March or if it was July of 2019. I'm getting the medical date and the recurrent date mixed up. The helicopter was a very capable Sikorsky S-76B. I don't know a lot about helicopters, but it's a big executive helicopter. I think it has 2 turbine engines on it. It was IFR equipped and capable, but not permitted to fly under the operation. Again, it was in good flying condition per the NTSB so far at the time of impact. So that's an important fact to lay out there. Some important facts to lay out there, because there was a lot of media stuff coming out that they didn't have a cockpit voice recorder and they didn't have a black box, and it wasn't allowed to fly under instrument conditions. So we need to differentiate between allowed to and actually having the instruments to do it, because there's a difference there between the type of operation that they're legally allowed to do at this outfit and what the aircraft is capable of doing. The aircraft was capable of doing all of it, you know, plenty of IFR in general. It was all equipped, okay? Nice helicopter, as you would expect. So it was equipped, it was capable, the pilot was trained and capable, but they weren't allowed to do it under their operation. So we need to have the distinction there. Cockpit voice recorders and black boxes are not common in small aircraft. I mean, even medium-sized aircraft are not common. We get that stuff once we get up into the airline category aircraft, okay? So there's a lot of data that they were still able to draw from this entire situation with radar returns and things, but it's not common to have those sorts of things on board. But again, going back to the fact that this was a capable IFR aircraft, the pilot was capable, experienced, very experienced, and so there shouldn't have been any issues there, okay? So now we get into more of my opinion, and this is the stuff that I would teach a student that we can learn from this entire situation. As pilots, we work very hard to make sure that we learn from other people's mistakes so that we don't have to repeat them. And if we can draw anything positive from this, we try to, and try to make sure that there's not another situation like this in the future. So I'm going to tell you some of the things we can learn from this and some of the things we should learn, and then what we can do, maybe some action steps we can take, even if it's in the midst of a flight that is deteriorating like this, what we can do to remain safe. So what we can learn. Some of the major types of accidents in aviation remain the same. And in this case, it looks like it was VMC into IMC, which we had subsequent disorientation, which means that the pilot's regular physical cues on his body were lying to him, and those cues of the body were not matching up to those that were on the instruments. So the reason why we make such a distinction between flying with visual flight rules and instruments is because of this, because we're used to standing here on the ground as humans. We're used to all the gravity cues and the inner ear cues that keep us upright here. But in an airplane, or a helicopter in this case, is totally different and can lead to the body telling you that you're doing something other than what is reality. And that's why we rely on the instruments to tell us what way is up, which way is left, right, etc., so that we can fly precisely with just the instruments without even being able to see outside, okay? So this VMC and the IMC, or visual conditions into instrument conditions, means that a pilot goes from not being able to see anything to then being in instrument conditions where he or she has to rely on just the instruments. This can happen not only in clouds like this, but it can happen at nighttime and other disorienting situations where there are some visual illusions. But this type of accident, this visual or VMC into IMC, continues to be a killer of pilots, mainly because pilots in general are a mission-oriented type of people. They get the job done, sort of thing. So they press on into situations where they shouldn't have, and the result is something like this without the proper training. As we can see here, even with the proper training, professionals can get caught up in issues with this, okay? So it's quite scary. You know, it's quite scary that we keep repeating these accidents. So again, it appears that the pilot got disoriented. You know, those body cues were maybe really hard for him to fight. Clearly, something was going on. Got disoriented, entered IMC, and lost control of the aircraft. It wasn't spinning out of control. It wasn't necessarily falling, but it was powered, and he got disoriented and flew a left ascending turn into the ground. So rewinding this whole process and looking back to the flight, the pilot persisted into poor weather regardless of the conditions. Now, it's likely that this was something that this pilot had done hundreds of times before, especially if he had flown around this area a lot of his career, which I don't really know the full workup of his logbook. But this is likely something that the pilot had done many times before. Now, we can get into a false sense of security by doing something we know we're not supposed to do, right? But we get this confirmation after doing it several hundred times that we don't face the consequences. And so what ends up happening a lot of times is people will go hundreds of times or thousands of times without an incident in a safety critical situation like this. And then that one time, it bites them, and that's what results in the problem. So just because you can get away with something doesn't mean that you should. And just because you can get away with something doesn't mean that you're actually going to get bit now. You might get bit or get hurt or kill yourself many steps, many years down the road because of that attitude, because of that thing that you're doing. All right? I mean, that's pretty intense language, but that's just the truth of it. Someone like this, also to mention, someone like this that is flying celebrities around, you know, VIPs, very important people. VIPs can be the type that would apply a lot of pressure to the pilots. I think in a lot of situations, we're in a healthy place with that now, where people realize that these accidents happen and they can't happen to anyone, and it's up to the pilot to do the safe thing. And as much as the pilots can resist that and know that, we still put pressure on ourselves. I can tell you that we put pressure on ourselves to accomplish the mission, accomplish the flight. And so even though what I heard is that Kobe basically acquiesced to the professionals, the professional pilots that were flying him, said, "It's up to your decision, keep us safe." I heard that even though that's the case, it doesn't mean that the pilot himself would not still feel an amount of pressure from some angle. You know, this pilot was not the owner of the company. He was the chief pilot in that company. But, you know, maybe there's pressure from the employer. Who knows if you consistently can't deliver for the customer, if you're afraid that customer will leave you. There are a bunch of different pressures, okay? So that external pressure can be added just by virtue of being a pilot. And of course, carrying around very important people, you know that. Yeah, like he knows who Kobe Bryant is. I'm sure there's plenty of other celebrities that he's flown around. So that's all part of it. Okay, pre-flight planning would have made very clear that it was going to be this type of day, and the pilot was unlikely surprised by the conditions. So yeah, the pilot knew what he was getting into. He knew that this weather wasn't going to be good moving up through where he was going. You never know exactly what the weather is going to be unless you have actual cameras there, which in some cases is the case. We have those in Alaska. Unless you have the actual cameras there, you know, you're going off by a lot of guesses, educated guesses on what the weather is going to be and some observations. So that's also something to keep in mind when we're looking at this. But he knew what he was getting into, at least we think we know what he was getting into, and persisted for quite a long time into these conditions because he started in John Wayne, went northbound into Burbank, and then went westbound through the valley and followed the 101 up. So they were deep into their flight by the time all this transpired. And likely didn't save themselves any time. That doesn't really matter. I'm not going to make that comparison, but you know, we know what happened at the end. So those are some things we can learn. Here's what we can do. Okay. Here's maybe some more actionable steps that we as pilots can do, learning specifically from this situation. So have personal minimums and stick to them. There's a personal minimums worksheet that you can find on the FAA website that can help you determine what your personal minimums should be. We as pilots, we have regulatory minimums already, which are dictated by the FAA, but our personal minimums are either either at those minimums, but I would suggest unless you're a very proficient pilot, they should be above those minimums in some way. And there are some areas of ambiguity that you're going to have to figure out anyway on what you will and won't fly in, all right? So having those personal minimums, having that margin between what the actual regulatory minimum is and what your minimum is gives you a buffer, okay, for those situations that might creep up where you can do something different, get out of the situation you're in, have room to land, call it a day, sit there wherever you are, starve, it doesn't matter, but you're alive. So have those personal minimums. Make your PIC authority very clear. You don't have to be a jerk about it, but you are the pilot in command, the PIC, and you are ultimately responsible for keeping people safe and keeping them alive. Sometimes there may come a time where you are keeping someone alive against their wishes, okay? In other words, they'll be pressuring you to do something, wanting you to do something that you know is unsafe, but you are the pilot in command. You need to decide what is safe, and at times that could be very inconvenient and even annoying to people, but that is something that you need to do. You need to take that mantle upon yourself and say, hey, this is who I am, this is what I'm going to do, and deal with the consequences for what they are. It's better than paying the ultimate consequence of losing your life. All right? Next one, stop. Just stop what you're doing. If you know it's deteriorating and it's bad, stop and divert. Do whatever you need to do to stop it now. The pilot passed over several suitable airports, like very suitable airports, and the passengers could have gone by car from their destination in a very short amount of time to get to where they were going. So it wasn't that this was the absolute only option to get to this event. I know that's a bit of a stretch and that's making a lot of judgments. But yeah, there are plenty of places the pilot could have stopped and said, hey, this isn't working. He could have stopped even between Van Nuys going up the 101 and seeing how low the clouds were. That's really the last chance, seeing how low the clouds were, to say, hey, I'm going to visually turn around right here and we're going to go back to Burbank and land. That's last ditch effort, right? So even that could have worked all the way past those other decisions. And that's likely like where the decision would be made for a professional pilot of his caliber. I'm not judging him for anything that he did up until he entered the clouds. Other than he knew he was picking his way through weather that he had probably gotten away with many times before. But there was a decision point there, a last chance, and they didn't take it. And it's not even to say that that was their last chance. Like, the pilot could have and was making the correct decision at the time to climb, even though their operation wasn't allowed to do IFR, he was making the correct decision to just climb up, get above the mountains, get level or whatever, and deal with the consequences from there, okay? But he pushed it too far. So anyway, there is always this break in the chain of events that happens much further before where the consequences are small, that you can make the decision to stop. Otherwise, yes, you have more chances, but the consequences and the potential outcomes become much more critical. Because what's to say when that pilot, if he decided to turn over the 101, still in visual conditions, if he had enough room to turn in that valley and come back the other direction. And it's not an airplane, right? Like a helicopter can hover and pivot, but still, maybe there was enough room there. And anyway, the consequences just get much greater the deeper you go down. And the consequence here, the potential consequence of going VMC into IMC, entering the clouds, a potential consequence was getting disoriented, and that's exactly what happened and ended the way it did. They were just several hundred feet from climbing above the cloud layer. The cloud layer, the tops are at 2,400 feet. They have cameras that prove this. The tops are at 2,400 feet. They were about 1,200 feet when they... All right. Take ego out of your flying entirely. That means go by what you know is guaranteed to be safe, not what you think could or might happen. Or, you know, in this example, thinking the weather might improve or thinking that pass might be fine or whatever it is. Go by what you know is guaranteed. That is the safe path to take. All right. Take ego out of it entirely. You know, all those things, the get there-itis, the invulnerability, the persisting into the bad weather. All right. This one's built upon that a little bit. You are not anything special. So you can be the most experienced professional and still make life-altering mistakes. We learned that lesson again and again and again and again. This won't be the last time we learn that lesson. There are many good professional pilots that make mistakes and ends up costing their lives. And as terrible as the consequence was in this case of a handful of people dying, some wonderful people dying, I would still say, without knowing him personally, but just going by what I know, I would say that this was probably a very good pilot and a very experienced pilot, and I wouldn't think anything different than that, okay? I go on that. I don't just take the stance that, oh, what an idiot for doing something like this. You're not learning the lesson if you take that stance. All right. And concluding with, we as pilots are the line of defense, often the last line of defense. Safety is absolutely and totally the most important thing we practice as pilots. Practice means we will do it when the time comes. So let me repeat that phrase again. We as pilots are the last line of defense. Safety is absolutely and totally the most important thing we practice as pilots. Practice means that we will do it when the time comes. So, in concluding, and I don't have any notes for this, but in concluding, I'm saddened we have to continue to learn these lessons again and again. I wish there wasn't such a terrible consequence of learning these lessons. And I hope that that sacrifice, I guess a sacrifice would be more of a willing sacrifice, but I hope that the tragedy of the Kobe Bryant incident or accident will save other people. And I just think it's really unfortunate that we keep repeating these mistakes, but there actually is something that we as pilots, in particular, as professionals connected to this industry that fly people like this around and people, just everyday people in general, we have a huge responsibility to fly safely because we're not only trying to get ourselves home, we're trying to get other people home safely too. Trying to get them here to there for business and all these other things that are demanding of their life. But inevitably, we've got to get them there safe or get them back safe or stop somewhere safely, whatever it is. We've got to do whatever we can. And I hope that you feel more inspired today to make changes to your aviation safety, to your mindset towards safety, to your commitment to break that chain that will happen in your aviation career. You break that chain and you stop. We never get second chances if it comes to a fatal accident, right? I guess there are people that have accidents that do have a second chance if they don't pass away. But what I mean by that is we need to be able to make the consistent, safe choices that lead to safe outcomes in aviation. We will never know what would have or could have happened if we would have persisted into that bad situation. And so in a sense, we don't get the reward of knowing that, but we know that we always return home safely. And hopefully, flight after flight, year after year, you continue to be a safe pilot that will return home safe to your family, that will help others return home safe to their family. And you'll take that aspect, that very serious of aspect of aviation, and really take it upon yourself to make a difference even if it's only for your own flying. And so that's my sermon today. I hope that that this podcast found you well, and I really appreciate it. Of course, comment with anything. If you have comments about this episode, if it really helped you, impacted you, the part you like the most, you could even tell me the time code you like. If you are interested in aviation and you would like to learn aviation, I do an online ground school and check ride preparation at angleofattack.com. We do talk a lot about these safety issues. So, really appreciate being here. Please spread the word for us of Angle of Attack and what we're trying to do here. And really appreciate it. Really appreciate you being here. And if you ever have a question, feel free to write me. Instagram is one of the best places right now to do that in direct messages. And keep being safe, okay? And as always, throttle on.
We sincerely thank you for joining us on Aviator Cast. Please subscribe through your favorite podcast service and leave a review. Check out more flight training resources at angleofattack.com. There you can find this podcast, many free aviation training videos, as well as online ground school for private instrument, commercial, and CFI. Got a check ride coming up? Check Ride Ace from Angle of Attack is your ultimate companion, guiding you through the process so you can conquer your big day. Thanks once again for joining us on Aviator Cast. Turn left, contact Ground Point Niner.